seated, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 060814, Texas Mutual Insurance Company versus Paul Ledbetter and others.
May it please the court, Ms. Kinney will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm here today on behalf of Texas Mutual. This appeal concerns the statutory subrogation rights of workers' compensation carriers in the settlement funds that are paid by third parties responsible for a covered employee's death or injury. The legislature has granted carriers the right to recover from those settlements with third parties, not only the workers' compensation benefits that have already been paid, but also to get a statutory credit against future benefits applied to those settlement proceeds. These are important statutory rights designed to reduce the high cost of our workers' compensation system. This case really deals with the procedural steps necessary to ensure the protection of those rights, and there was something of a procedural morass in the trial court, so I'd like to go through some of the facts just to give a context. In this case, the employee was Charles Ledbetter. He was electrocuted while acting in the course and scope of his employment. Texas Mutual, the employer's insurer, began paying death benefits to his widow and his minor child. The plaintiffs here, consisting of his widow, his minor child, his two adult children, and the estate, sued two non-employer defendants, Nelms Electric and Williams.
Ask about the money that went to the estate. What do we know what happened to that after it went to the estate?
Well, Your Honor, the judgment and the settlement, and that's part of the record, it has the most complicated set of annuities and payments set up that I think I have ever seen. I'm not quite, but some of it has been paid out. Some of it is in the process of being paid out through the estate.
Does it go to the wife and son?
No, it also goes to the adult children. And about half of it went to the lawyers. About 2.4 actually went into the estate. Some of it was to go for the benefit of the minor child, but it was up to Mrs. Ledbetter to decide how the payments were to be made. Unfortunately, Ms. Ledbetter is now deceased. She died after the trial court's judgment was entered. So if the court agrees with us on the issue we have regarding the non-suit, we would need to substitute in her estate. We don't believe it's all been paid out, but a substantial amount of it has been.
So she was she's trustee for some of the funds?
She was the administratrix of the estate, yes.
Does your right to subrogation depend at all on whether the money went directly to Ledbetter family members as opposed to the estate, or is it all the same?
We have a $6,000 claim against the estate for funeral expenses, and that's it. And that's really what's critical here, is that our subrogation rights are limited to the rights, the recovery that should be allocated to the widow and to the minor child, because those are the two people to whom Texas Mutual is paying benefits. We don't have any obligation to pay benefits to the adult children. We now pay the full amount of the benefit on behalf of the minor child. After Ms. Ledbetter died, there has been no guardian. We've not been informed of any guardian. We're just basically escrowing those proceeds at this point.
But they've all been non-suited.
They have been non-suited, and that is the problem that we see in this
case. Is the $6,000 part of the $27,940?
No, it's not, Your Honor. That's all. The almost $28,000 was the amount that had been paid as of the date of trial.
Don't you have a case pending right now?
Pardon?
Isn't there a case pending right now between the comp carrier and the defendants?
Yes.
Has anyone pled that you're barred by this settlement agreement from making recovery?
I believe all the other litigation has been abated pending the resolution of this appeal.
Could they plead that?
Could they?
How could this settlement bar your subrogation, your direct action against the defendants?
How could against Nelms and Scotsman?
Against the defendants responsible for the damages to the deceased. The statute puts you in the deceased's shoes and in the shoes of the beneficiaries, correct?
That's correct.
And that's the lawsuit you have pending at this time.
That's a lawsuit that we have pending.
How could anything that's taken place up to this point damage or harm your rights against the defendants?
I think the judgment in this case in the trial court did do precisely that.
How? Can they plead that against you? Is it a bar in any way, a release of your rights in any way?
I believe that they adjudicated the rights of the of Mrs. Ledbetter and of the minor child.
That's who you represent.
We stand in their shoes.
Right.
And if they have a judgment, what we have left is a conversion claim against parties who receive money out of that settlement.
But let's say you try your case against the defendant, and the jury says they were negligent, they caused the death, $1 million worth of damages. Doesn't that make you whole?
If we can pursue that, but I think what Nelms and Scotsman would raise is the bar of this judgment in this case.
What I'm wondering, that's what I was trying to ask.
Yes, I think that does.
That bars your claim that the statute gives you. Can someone else bar your claim?
If we stand in, we have a right of subrogation, and we stand in the shoes of Mrs. Ledbetter and the minor child. If they already have a settlement and a judgment that cuts off their rights, that constitutes a conversion of the funds that should have been allocated to us. I think we have a problem going against Nelms and Scotsman under those circumstances.
But let me try the same question. If there's a hospital in, and the tortfeasors give all the money to the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney and don't pay the hospital, then the tortfeasor gets to pay twice. That's what hospital ins do. They put you on notice to say, don't pay that money to them, and if the tortfeasor plows ahead and pays the money to them, then the tortfeasor gets to pay twice. Don't these people get to pay twice? They were on notice that you were claiming you owned part of the plaintiff's cause of action.
Nelms and Scotsman may be subject to a similar conversion claim.
But what we're trying to get is there any possible way they could escape that? Because if there's any possible way they could escape that, then you're not harmed. If there's no possible way, if they're just going to have to pay twice, I mean, are they bankrupt, or is there no insurance left? Or
I believe there is adequate funds to retrieve this. What we are seeking here is a determination that the plaintiffs are not entitled to exit from this, so that we can have adjudicated as to them our rights to continue to pay benefits, because that is basically what has happened. By allowing the plaintiffs here to take a non-suit, we will not be able to adjudicate as to the minor child and the Ledbetter estate whether we were obligated to continue to pay benefits, because they are the parties to whom we owe those benefits. We need an opportunity to adjudicate our rights and obligations as to them, and that's why they should be required to remain as parties in this litigation. The other problem.
Let me interrupt you just a moment. You're suing the defendants, and if you get a judgment for $1 million, you've paid $6,000 and $27,000, and then you have an obligation for future payments. All right. Let's say your obligation for future payments is $100,000. So you've got a judgment for $800,000 excess of your liability to the under the comp law. What happens to that $800,000?
We would not be entitled to that.
Sure,
that
you
would,
wouldn't.
That would be.
But the defendants now have bought their peace with the people that would be entitled to it, wouldn't it? Wouldn't they? You're just entitled to get your money back and offset anything you would be able to pay. So it looks to me like that the defendants in this case have simply paid and bought their peace for any excess over what you might recover against them. Am I missing that analysis somehow in this?
No, I don't think you are, Your Honor. But I think that to have this adjudicated in a simple fashion in one lawsuit, the plaintiffs need to be required to remain in this case. We got most of the relief that we needed from the Court of Appeals, and I think that they intended to grant us the relief that we needed. They said, yes, we're entitled to intervene. You don't need to have these plaintiffs in this case because you can pursue your relief against the estate itself to get that money back. And we also do still have Scotsman and Nelms in this case. But what we are seeking to do is to require the plaintiffs to be here so that we can adjudicate whether or not we have to continue to make payments. It creates essentially a procedural morass.
Doesn't the statute simply give you the right to stop making payments?
Well, we had a court order that ordered us to continue to do that.
But that, what happened to that in the Court of Appeals opinion?
The Court of Appeals reversed and remanded to have a determination as to how much should be, basically to determine what the fair allocation would be. And I think most of the allocation should go to the widow and the minor child because they were totally dependent upon the deceased for support.
Now that you're, that the Court of Appeals has reversed the denial of your intervention petition, can't you go back then in the trial court and sue the individual plaintiffs?
We can. And, in fact, that's one of the problems is that not being able to allowing them to have the non-suit has resulted in another lawsuit. It's actually, you know, in another county, and that is pending. That's abated. And that really is the purpose of this appeal is to clarify what the procedure needs to be. Employers Casualty versus Henniger decision out of the Court of Appeals until this decision out of Eastland came down was the law in this state, which was that a claimant, such as Mrs. Ledbetter and the minor child, could not non-suit their claims in an effort to circumvent the carrier's right of reimbursement and right of future credit.
So you can bring them right back into the case, can't you, or not?
I think that we could. I think that they should not be allowed to be dismissed because what happens is we end up with essentially procedural problems.
Bringing them in doesn't help because they don't have any money.
They don't have any.
It's all their relatives.
Well, actually, some of it has, we believe it's been distributed to them. We're not sure exactly where the money has gone at this
point. But it was set up so they wouldn't have any money.
It was set up certainly so that the minor child, who's the person we now have to pay all benefits to, would not receive any money until his majority. But it was given to the to the mother as his guardian at that time. But the Henniger decision made it clear that parties could not do this. And what happens is that to allow them to take non-suits of this sort encourages this type of attempt to circumvent the statute.
If this works, everybody will do it.
Exactly. And it also basically spawns multiplicity of litigation, where we have a lot of lawsuits. If they're not allowed to take the non-suit, we keep it all in one lawsuit, we unravel it, and we fix it. And it will discourage plaintiffs from attempting to do this in the future.
And that'll make comp rates go up. Why?
Would help make them go down if it would clarify the system.
If you lose, everybody does it their way, you have to file extra lawsuits and comp rates go up.
Exactly. And so I think that that's why it's important to keep these people in the lawsuit so that we won't have any question about the adjudication of the subrogation rights. And I'll, if the court has no more questions, I'll.
Further questions?
Down.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
Please the court. Mr. Hall will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. Your Honors, this first let me say regarding, among other things, rates going up, this is an unusual case. Part of the reason it's unusual is the insurance company chose to do nothing, and that is they chose not to hire lawyers. Apparently,
chose not to
hire lawyers, apparently, until the very end. They were involved in the case, investigation of the case from the start.
Why have two lawyers prosecuting the plaintiff, one plaintiff's case against the defendants?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Why have two sets of lawyers doing the same thing?
Well, they didn't have any sets of lawyers.
But the plaintiffs did. The family of the guy who died had lawyers,
yes,
who had every incentive to go after the defendants.
Yes.
Why have an insurance company lawyer there looking over his shoulder other than to make comp more expensive?
Well, for one thing, to pursue their comp plan. They waited until the very day. The statement was made earlier that they didn't have the chance to litigate. They did have the chance to litigate.
But
they had the chance to litigate that very day.
There's nothing to litigate. They're entitled to the first money.
Well, they're entitled to first money, sir, but I believe the law is clear that if there is disagreement on how much that first money is, if it's not agreed, then that has to be proven. The cases say...
But you think it would be better for the subrogated comp carrier to get in the lawsuit early and start fussing with the plaintiffs over how much they're going to get?
Well, I don't know how much fussing it would require, sir.
Well, it's required a lot in this case.
Well, that's because they didn't prove it. They waited till the last minute and didn't prove it. For instance, you know the cases say, Diaz says, the cases I've cited, Diaz, Lara, those cases, say it has to be an arithmetic calculation. Now, in this case, they want to say over and over, they want to say we've proved it. They haven't. For one thing, I believe that 6,000 is part of the 27,000. But let's go a step further. Whether that's true or not, let's go a step further. If you take what they tried to prove with their lawyer that day, it's $376 a week. If you calculate that out, it comes to, if you take 4 weeks in a month, it comes to $1,500-something. If you take 4 1/3, it comes to $1,600-something.
But you're...
On the other hand, sir, Mrs.
Very interesting, but let me... You set this, or whoever set this settlement up, was there any purpose other than to make sure that the insurer got zero?
Yes. That had really nothing to do with it. The insurer was called and said, come prove up your deal. What happened was...
No. You're misunderstanding my question. The fella died, right?
Right.
Got a wife and a minor child, and we settle the case, and they get zero. That's not normally the way people settle that case. And I'm trying to find out, is the reason they got zero, the sole reason they got zero, is to make sure the folks at that table got zero.
That has nothing to do with it.
Well, why don't you set it up that way?
The Court of Appeals opinion makes some reference to $400-something thousand by their calculation saved in taxes. In fact, it was a good deal more than that. If that money goes to the adult kids, the minor child, the wife, it's taxable.
So as to make sure the government and the insurer got nothing?
Well, I believe tax planning is a part of our society.
Well, there's no question a major part of this judgment was for the guy's wages. I mean, that's what it was, right? He didn't have a whole lot of medical expenses.
No, he did not have medical expenses.
So the entire judgment was for future earnings, which are supposed to be taxable, right?
Oh, I don't agree that that was the entire judgment.
It was the major part.
That's not the way it was structured. And whether it would have been the major part or not, I don't know.
I'm troubled about non-suiting when you've got a minor child. You've got a minor here, and let's say it's a different case, so it's a paraplegic minor child who's been injured. Can the next friend just come in and non-suit when there's some evidence, let's say, that the next friend personally just got $1 million from the defendant? A court would have to stop that, wouldn't they?
Are you asking me, should we rely on the trial courts to protect the children?
Your case is you can non-suit anytime you want. And I'm just trying to posit a different case, not your case. A paraplegic injured minor child represented by parent next friend. There's evidence the parent took $1 million personally and now non-suits the minor's claim. A trial judge would have to say no, wouldn't they?
Are you positing that the minor child gets nothing?
Yes, and non-suit.
And there is no provision for that child to get
no settlement, no nothing.
Well, I believe
my absolute right to non-suit. A judge would have to stop that.
I believe the trial court would be duty-bound to stop that.
So there is an exception to the absolute right to non-suit, and since a minor was involved here, trial judge should have thought about that, right?
I'm sure he did, and I'm sure that he tried, that he took whatever steps were necessary and did take whatever steps were necessary to make sure that that minor child was protected. The harm, there is no harm to, in this case, to the insurance carrier. They did not prove to an arithmetic certainty anything, nothing. They had a chance to prove it, both with questions to the claimants, or plaintiffs, as you wish to call them, and by what they presented. As far as arithmetic certainty, which LARM requires, which DIS requires, which and in the case of an intervention, which the EVR case requires, the arithmetic certainty, in that case, it's not here. On the one hand, there's other cases, I believe Laura, and I believe this, and for that matter, Serrano, and I'll tell you why I say Serrano in a second, that say it must be an amount. There are instances where somebody testified in one case, approximately $203. Approximately cannot be calculated. It has to be exact amounts. And
if they had proved it by an exact amount here, would there have been harm?
Sure.
So that's the only thing that's missing is how exact was it?
As far as harm in the judgment for nothing, yes. They didn't prove it.
Did they prove anything, a minimum?
In my opinion, no.
So there's no evidence whatsoever of the amount that they paid in benefits?
Not as required by the law. Because it's got to be an arithmetic certainty. The testimony.
Is there an arithmetic certainty of a minimum amount paid in benefits here?
No.
In the record?
She said approximately $1,258. The attorney said $376. But assume that $376 is accurate. There is absolutely nothing about how many weeks. So what do you multiply 376 by?
Well,
it's not there.
As you said, they just intervened that day.
That's correct.
The day they got kicked out. Normally, if you wanted to kick them out because they didn't prove it, you'd have to file a summary judgment, wouldn't you?
True.
Normally, you can't just the day somebody files a petition, go to the judge, have a little quick hearing, and dismiss it because they hadn't proved their case, can you?
They didn't have to intervene that day. They could have, as I said earlier, they could have intervened earlier and done all these things.
Plaintiff's attorneys don't have to file their car wreck cases the last day of a two-year limitations period. They always do, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. So is there something that bars them? Do they waive something by intervening before the judgment is signed?
Do they waive something?
Right.
No.
Don't they have a right before everything's dismissed to say, if you say we have no claim, file a summary judgment, which you didn't do?
Do they waive anything? No. But do they gain some kind of advantage because they just filed it that day? Is the requirement of proof somehow less because they don't because they only required it that day? No, sir. They have to prove the same thing as everybody else.
To file an intervention, they have to do that?
Yes. The EVR case is an intervention. In that case, the amount in question was not agreed upon, and the intervenor was required to prove it or fail to recover. That's in the case, and it's also...
They're not here saying they want us to order them to recover. They're just here saying we wanted not to be kicked out.
Well, they had every opportunity to plead and prove their case that day. They didn't do it.
But how does that get their intervention stricken? I mean, you might have a take-nothing judgment, but how do you get stricken out of a case because you didn't prove it?
That, Your Honor, that's a hard question to answer for me.
Well, let me ask you the question we were asking opposing counsel here. Aren't they still entitled to maintain a lawsuit against the defendants? Have you prejudiced by this settlement that you, regardless of how that money was allocated, aren't they still entitled to go against these defendants? The defendants knew that there was a comp carrier in there, and under the Texas law, they're entitled to dollars under a statute. And yet the defendants went ahead and paid you and took a release from you. Can your clients or could you release the comp carrier's claim?
No.
They had their own attorneys, independent representation. No one said they were released. So regardless of how that money was allocated to you, how have they been harmed?
I believe they haven't. In fact, the statutory structure is such that they have the right to proceed on their own.
So how do they get to now, assuming that to be the case, they get to go against the defendants, and the defendants get to pay again if they prove their case. And in the meantime, they don't want to pay your client. They don't want to pay the weekly comp benefits. So do they have to? Is it your position they have to keep paying those?
It's my position they didn't prove it, and they do.
Okay, they have to keep paying them.
Yes.
All right. Now then, so if they recover against the other defendant, do they get to keep all of that money, everything they have paid, and they pay in the future up till that judgment? Is that your position? Say
yes.
They get the $1 million judgment, and they've paid, say, $100,000 to your clients. They get $100,000 from the defendants. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Now then, what happens to the other $900,000? Does your client get it, or they just get to offset that against the payments they make against your client? How does that work?
I don't know if the exact word would be offset, but it would.
Under the statute, say offset?
Yes, the $100,000 in your postulation would be offset.
Okay.
But I'm referring to the additional amounts. I don't know if the word would be offset, but certainly it would be the property of the two defendants rather than the Ledbetters.
Okay. So how does the comp carrier not get out of having to pay the continuing comp to your clients then, without your clients being in the lawsuit as they contend? They have to go back through the commission? How do they get to offset that?
Our opinion is it's res judicata.
So your opinion is this judgment, in fact, does what they're complaining about.
Between us and them.
This judgment makes them, you're up here wanting the judgment to make them continue paying you and your clients in the future then.
That's correct. Okay. The burden, in our opinion, the burden was on the comp carrier as a party asserting subrogation rights when there's not agreement on the amounts.
Well, they knew how much they were paying every week. No question about that, was there? Didn't your client testify to that?
It wasn't shown. Your Honor, in my opinion, she didn't.
She didn't say how much was being paid for.
She said approximately $1,258. The courts have held that that is not sufficient.
But that's not in the past. That's in the future.
Well, it was in the past and the future. The amount wouldn't change in that sense. She would be entitled. She said her and her son, I believe, and they would be entitled to the same amount because his wage rate, wouldn't change. And if there was something, for instance, say that he was at the upper limit, and later it changed as an upper limit. My view of the comp law is that whatever period of time it was when you were killed, it stays there.
Well, let me ask this question then. Say, okay, there is a judgment telling them to continue paying in the future?
There is a judgment out of the trial court, yes, Your Honor.
Out of the trial court? Okay.
But the Court of Appeals reversed that. And so in that sense, there isn't a judgment. It's not being paid right now. It's a static amount.
I'm a little unclear about your answers to my question and Justice Johnson's. I ask you, if there had been proof to arithmetic certainty, would the carrier have been harmed by the way this was handled? And I thought you said yes.
Yes.
Justice Johnson says, but if they can still get it from the defendants, is there any real harm? And I thought you said no. But isn't there harm because they don't get first money? Aren't they entitled to first money?
Yes.
And
if they prove it.
And if this works, won't everybody do this?
If what works, Your Honor?
If it works, when you've received comp, that you sue the bad guys, and then you have them pay your relatives, then, in fact, comp carriers will never get their money back.
They're not... The comp carrier should not lose here because the non-suit occurred. The comp carrier should lose here because they didn't plead and prove what they're entitled to.
The day they intervened.
the day they intervened. They chose to do it all at once.
And that's because you objected, or the trial counsel objected to their putting on proof?
He did object, but he did put on the proof.
Well, an offer of proof after the objection was sustained.
Well, no, he actually was entitled to show with Mrs. Ledbetter that amount about approximately and so on. He didn't get to go further, like on the pain and suffering and so on. But then he put on the bill with his testimony. If there are no other questions, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
Plaintiffs.
Did you prove it?
Did we prove it? Yes, we did. But I think we also don't have to, and that's what the Court of Appeals held. And that's one of the basically, Texas Mutual walked into an ambush in the trial court. They were invited to this by the counsel for the plaintiffs, and their interest was recognized when they got there. Plaintiffs' counsel essentially went on, set out to deprive Texas Mutual of any recovery at all, and I think the record will reflect that.
Why is it that you don't have to prove your claim? You just show up and say we paid this, and you think you're entitled to receive it because you say so?
No, and we did prove it. What happened was we thought, okay, what happened was when we showed up, they moved to strike our intervention completely. And the trial court granted the motion to strike the intervention. And so what the Court of Appeals held, and we think correctly, is that you're out. And if you're out, we don't really need to look at your evidence. It's improper to have stricken your intervention. We're going to put you back in, and we're going to remand so that you can look at the reasonableness of this settlement and whether it was properly allocated.
Said you proved your claim.
We did, over a lot of objection. What we managed to get into the record on cross-examination of Mrs. Ledbetter was that she was paid $1,258 a month, she and her minor child both, for the 15 months after her husband had died. And that came up to just about $28,000.
And if you didn't,
we may not have proved up the cents.
And if you didn't prove up your claim, you said you still you're entitled to relief. Because you said you don't have to prove up your claim.
We're claiming that we were stricken from the case, and if we're stricken from the case, the evidentiary hearing it becomes irrelevant, and so therefore we need to be reinstated. Our intervention needs to be reinstated, and we need to have a remand for a proper hearing. But we also had, as a matter of law, the continuing obligation to make future payments. And the court would not allow examination, even of Mrs. Ledbetter, regarding the fairness of the allocation. There wasn't any evidence in the record, really, that Mr. Ledbetter suffered from the electrocution. He died almost immediately. And there was no testimony that would support allocating $4.5 million to the estate. That was the other issue that we were trying to address in this hearing. And it was not a trial. It was a hearing to determine the reasonableness of the settlement. And we think we put sufficient evidence in the record to show that this particular settlement that the trial court approved was not reasonable and the case needs to go back.
Just out of curiosity, I thought I read in the briefs that the settlement was for $4.5 million, a net of $2,388,545.40.
Yes.
Why the difference? Was the record reflect that? I haven't
Attorney's fees and cost.
So about half attorney fees?
Yes. And, Your Honor, counsel made a comment that what they were trying to do was not to circumvent Texas Mutual's rights but to save taxes, and they say that the Court of Appeals noted that that's what they were doing. In fact, the Court of Appeals noted that the basic mess that was created in the trial court has probably resulted in almost $500,000 in estate tax liability because they threw all of the money into the estate in a year when the estate tax exemption was only $1 million. And I'm not an estate tax lawyer, but the Eastland Court of Appeals footnote on that point appears to be correct. I don't see how you can put $2.5 million in an estate and avoid the estate tax. And And Justice Johnson, back to your point, because I don't feel like I answered your question very well, but I think you may have gotten your answer from my opponent, but I want to be clear, is that our rights to go against the other defendants and to file a second lawsuit against the Ledbetters as well, we are still harmed. We are not made whole by that. If we had the right to litigate an entire claim against Scotsman and Nelms, litigation of third-party liability claims is expensive, what we're entitled to is the first money in the settlement of this case, and it's simply a matter of determining where the $4.5 million needs to go. It also, to allow the Ledbetters to pull out in this way and to require, you know, further action against Elms and Scotsman would allow the Ledbetters to have a double recovery. And I think that as a matter of policy, that should not be allowed.
In the suit against the Nelms and who's the other?
Scotsman.
Scotsman. Are you required to prove their liability or just your benefits paid?
If we were required to bring an independent lawsuit that without them. Regard to the settlement that they have with the Ledbetters, we would be, you know, put to the same proof.
We'd have to prove liability.
And
what if the jury says zero? Then you're out? Is that how it works?
We wouldn't have a right under that case. We think we would still have a conversion action with regard to the settlement funds in this. And that's the whole point, is that we need to create a process and make it very clear, because this is a problem that occurs across the state. This is a common problem. It is one other cases that involve this, where plaintiffs and their counsel essentially, you know, they reach a settlement with the third party defendants, and they don't want to share. They don't want to pay the workers' comp carriers, and we need a clear statement from this court that will not be tolerated. And that the mechanisms, and I think that the Henniger case set up a mechanism that made it simple, made it clear, kept all the parties together. I think that's for the benefit of also Nelms and Scotsman, that I understand that, you know, what they did was improper. I think they were heavily pressured. It's obviously a very large settlement. I think that there was some fear on their part, and that's why they went ahead and settled. But I think if we have a system that ensures that the carrier will be reimbursed, and we are entitled to wait. We don't have to intervene in these lawsuits. We could have waited. We're not required to participate. But that if we do, we're going to be protected, and the parties are going to be required to establish the proper allocation of the settlement. And if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll give back a minute.
No further questions, so the cause is committed, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.